Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, last week, the CDC endorsed the use of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID vaccine in children ages 5 to 11. It was an announcement many families around the country had been anxiously awaiting. Since then, about a million kids have rolled up their sleeves to receive the shot. But according to recent surveys, more than half of American parents remain hesitant. They question how safe it is, how effective it is, and whether young children need it in the first place. Apoorva Mandavilli is a reporter at the New York Times. She covers science and global health, which for the last year and a half has meant to focus on the coronavirus, vaccinations, and the government agencies managing this public health crisis. She joined me Friday morning to answer questions about kids and vaccines. Apoorva, vaccinations for children 5 to 11 began last week. Tell us how the rollout has gone thus far.
I think it's going okay. The administration said a couple of days ago that about a million kids between 5 and 11 have gotten the dose. But I know also that many parents are frustrated because schools and pediatricians' offices have not had as many vaccines as they wanted. And so it's been difficult for many parents to find an appointment to get a shot for their kid.
Now, what I heard was that the waiting time was about 3 weeks. Is that still the case?
I think that's probably getting better. And, you know, the administration did say that it was going to take a few days to ramp up. But I know many, many parents who have had to stand in line for 3 or 4 hours and then were told at the end of that that they had run out. So
that is frustrating. But I gather that even with that kind of rollout, many parents are still quite hesitant.
I think they are. You know, there are some parents who want to wait and see what comes out about the safety of the vaccines. They don't trust that the clinical trials were big enough or were followed long enough for them to feel really confident that the vaccine is safe for their kids. And so there are a lot of parents who are on the fence. There are some parents who don't want to get the vaccine at all. About a third in surveys have said they do not intend to get the vaccine for their kids. Some of that is because they don't think that the vaccines are needed for their kids. They think kids are at very low risk, and so they're just not convinced about the children's risk. And then some people, I think, are worried about things like myocarditis, the side effect that's been talked about a lot. You know, everything is a matter of risk and benefit. And I think some of the parents are looking at the statistics, looking at the fact that only a few hundred children have died of COVID so far. You could look at that as only a few hundred children, or you could say 600 children have died of COVID. So it's a matter of perspective for some people. And I think the fear about the vaccines unknowns, you know, it's an mRNA vaccine, it's new, we don't know anything about it, combined with this idea that maybe it's not needed, is just making some parents hesitate. On the other hand, you know, the uptake for kids over 12 has been getting better and better, and I think we're about 70% now. So it might just be a matter of time. It might also be that as numbers go back up, which they seem to be in many parts of the country, that parents will become convinced that they do actually need to go get their kids vaccinated.
Apoorva, do we know how many young children have already had the COVID virus?
It's a very difficult question to answer because a lot of kids don't have symptoms and don't get tested. So we don't really know. At one of the CDC meetings recently, one of the CDC scientists stood up and said something. They think that something like 40% of the kids in the U.S. have been exposed to COVID. But then I spoke to many experts who said they didn't think that was anywhere close to the number, that it was much, much less than that, because a lot of the time when we had these big waves of infections, kids were at home. They weren't at school. They weren't getting exposed. And so they don't think it's quite as high. So really, there's disagreement on what that number is. We just don't know.
What do the trials tell us about exactly how safe this vaccine is.
So the trials have shown that kids have about the same side effects as everybody else. You know, they have some pain in their arm after getting the injection. They feel a little tired. They feel a little feverish. My daughter got her vaccine yesterday. She's feeling all those things today. But beyond that, there aren't any serious side effects that have been observed. And one of the things these trials did also to minimize side effects is they looked at the smallest dose you can give to kids and get the effect that you need, the immune response that you need, without having bad side effects. And so kids 5 to 11 are getting 10 micrograms of the Pfizer vaccine, whereas adults got 30 micrograms. So they are going with the smallest dose possible in order to minimize side effects. And I think with that dose, they have not really seen anything of concern.
Of course, at the same time, we, and perhaps not even the scientists and doctors who are recommending this, have no idea of what the long-term effects could be. Who can tell what can happen 20 or 30 years out? Not even these scientists.
Right. And we don't have the luxury of waiting that many decades before some kind of side effect pops up. What we know is that for the vast majority of vaccines, any side effects that are going to occur within the first couple of weeks. And we have not seen anything like that in these clinical trials to be of concern. Even the myocarditis risk, which has been talked about a lot, including by me, I know I've written a lot about it, but it's important to put that risk in perspective. It's highest in males 16 to 29, and even there, it's about 11 cases per 100,000. So it's not common. And that risk is even lower in kids 12 and under. So we don't need to be as concerned about the side effects immediately anyway as I think some people are. But I do understand that it is an unknown and people just want more information before they make a decision.
You mentioned myocarditis. Explain what that is.
Sure. So myocarditis essentially means it's an inflammation of the heart muscle. And in some people, the vaccine seems to be causing this condition. And another one called pericarditis, which is an inflammation of the lining of the heart. But these things also occur just in the general population. So what they look at is how much more the vaccine might cause it compared to the general population. Myocarditis can also occur after any viral infection, including flu and COVID. And so with COVID, there is a much higher risk of myocarditis than there is with the COVID vaccine. And one really interesting thing I've been hearing from some experts and some doctors who see kids is that the myocarditis that they're seeing after the vaccine should almost have a separate name, because what they're seeing is not as severe or as long-lasting as what they would see with a viral infection like COVID. So they think it's unfortunate, actually, that they're all being called myocarditis, because qualitatively they're so different, and they have not really seen any kids so far or any young adults so far have permanent damage.
Well, and that takes me directly to the next question. When parents see that children end up with mild cases of COVID, then they say, well, my child can deal with a mild case, so why do I have to move on to the vaccine? What do you say to them?
A lot of the people who argue that kids are not at risk look at hospitalization data and at death data, but those are not the only things that matter. So you could have long-term side effects from COVID, as you do with many viral illnesses. We know that long COVID is this mysterious condition we don't know enough about yet, but we know that it affects some percent of people who get mildly sick, and that could include children. We don't know how common that is. There's also this condition, the multi-inflammatory syndrome, that has affected more than 5,000 kids so far in the United States. So it's important to look at all of the numbers and not just the very low death rate.
What actually is long COVID, and how does that begin? How is that different from getting COVID, getting over it, and that's that?
Long COVID is defined a little bit differently by different groups of experts, but in general, it means when symptoms persist long after the viral infection has resolved. So the acute infection is gone, but you still feel really tired, or you still have difficulty breathing, or any of those COVID symptoms. And what's troubling about long COVID is that it seems to happen even in people, and maybe even especially in people who don't get severely sick. So you may think you have a really mild bout of COVID, but you don't really fully recover for weeks and weeks and weeks. And how long that lasts and how frequent it is, how common it is really varies depending on the study. You know, the estimates are anywhere from a few weeks to many months, and from, you know, a few percent of those who get COVID to as many as half of all people who get COVID. So we don't really know a ton of solid information at this point about long COVID. I think we're still learning a lot about it.
What about the issue that some parents bring up regarding children's fertility later in life?
That is absolutely not a concern. I think there are a lot of myths out there, a lot propagated by the anti-vax movement, about fertility risks in kids, fertility risk for women. None of those are true. A lot of the worries are about this mRNA vaccine, but actually the mRNA lasts for a very short time in your body, and it does not have any of this kind of long-term impact that people think it might. So most of these worries are really unfounded.
What is the difference between the mRNA vaccine and other vaccines?
So some vaccines are based on using an inactivated version of the virus. So the virus is killed. It can't really cause disease, but you use the entire virus in the vaccine to get a big immune response. These vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, are using the genetic code for one protein of the virus. It's the protein that's in many ways the most important. It's the one that docks onto human cells and allows the virus to infect the cells. So what they're trying to do with these mRNA vaccines is teach the body how to recognize that protein so that when they see the virus, they would attack it. And so the mRNA vaccines have a code, a genetic code for this protein. And when the vaccine is injected, you make a little bit of that protein, and then your body learns, oh, this is what that looks like, and learns to fight it.
Your body learns, reacts, and develops some, not only a warning system, but overcomes what could be the negative part of that injection.
Yeah, it's really miraculous, isn't it? Our immune system is amazing. And over the past couple of years, I've learned so much about it from writing these articles.
Oh, I'm sure. You've been following this for so long.
It's been quite an education, you know, and really just I've been marveling at how complicated and sophisticated our immune system is. You know, you mentioned an early warning system. So there is an early warning system that is in every person, stronger in kids than in adults, that alerts you immediately to a virus or pathogen of some kind. But then there are also these longer-term responses. So we've all heard about antibodies. Your body takes a few days to make those. And then when the infection is gone, the amount of antibodies goes down, but there are still some cells that know how to make those antibodies. And then there are other cells that remember what the virus looks like or the protein looks like. And so you have all of this immune memory in your body that can be marshaled when you encounter the virus. It's really quite amazing.
What are the warning signs that one may be developing COVID?
When you have an infection, you may start to feel some inflammation, basically fever. You may start to feel some tightness in your chest. You may start to feel symptoms of a cold. You may lose your sense of smell. And a lot of that is because of where the virus goes. So if the virus is mostly in your nose and your throat, you know, that's when you have a cough and you can't smell. But if the virus has gotten into your lungs, that's when you start to have trouble breathing. So it's a matter of how far the virus gets into your system before your immune system can get rid of it.
And that is too late by then to get the vaccine.
It is, unfortunately. The vaccine doesn't work fast enough for you to get it right when you have COVID and have it work, which is why, you know, these idea of these antiviral drugs, the treatments are so important. You know, vaccines have to be given and then your body has to learn. As I said, that takes a couple of weeks to 3 weeks. Then we get the second dose, which really strengthens that immune response. And then, you know, you're fully vaccinated and you're ready to go. And that's a very long process. So when you have COVID, there really isn't enough time for the vaccine to do its job. Your body does some of the job. Your body produces, you know, some immune cells and all of that. And that's why some people have very mild illness, because their immune system works well. And this is why older adults have trouble fighting off COVID, because as you get older, your immune system gets weaker. There's something around age 50 or so that things start to, you know, deteriorate, and then you don't fight off infections as easily.
Well, now, suppose that this new drug that they are talking about, I gather it's in development or may be on the verge of being publicly given. Is that something that could prevent COVID from happening?
There are a couple of drugs, one from Merck and one from Pfizer and several others in development that can work as treatments. So once you have severe COVID, they can make your symptoms better. They can keep you maybe from ending up in the hospital. But they don't necessarily prevent COVID. There are other things that can prevent COVID. So monoclonal antibodies, which you may have heard of, those are essentially these, you know, if you think of a lot of antibodies as being very powerful against the virus, it's like taking one of those antibodies and really purifying it and strengthening it. So it's done artificially, but it's based on antibodies that the body produces. And they have seen now, this is the monoclonal antibody treatment that, for example, President Trump got when he was sick. It was a cocktail of two monoclonal antibodies made by Regeneron that he got. But now there's some evidence that if you get that antibody early, you can actually prevent COVID. So for some immunocompromised people for whom the vaccines don't work very well, a long-acting monoclonal antibody might be the solution. They might need to get a monoclonal antibody once a year or once, you know, every 10 months or whatever it ends up being, and that would protect them from COVID.
And, of course, we still don't know whether this vaccine is going to have to be given yearly as the flu vaccine is. And it's so interesting because each year, the flu vaccine that we get sometimes misses the mark because scientists are relying on what we got last year. And could that same problem arise with a yearly COVID vaccine?
As you said, we don't really know if we're going to need a yearly vaccine. There's a lot of discussion about this right now, even because of the boosters, because some scientists say, you know, the two vaccines are enough for quite a long time, and then maybe you'll need another one, you know, down the line. But there are some experts who are saying, no, this is a three-dose vaccine. We need to have all three doses to really seal in the immunity. There is also this sense that the virus is going to keep changing, and so we may need other versions of this vaccine down the line, you know, and Pfizer and Moderna have both been working on a version of the vaccine for Delta, the Delta variant specifically. The flu virus changes a lot faster, which is one of the reasons that the vaccine is never 100% on. You know, by the time you've gotten to the actual virus that's circulating, it's changed enough from when you started to develop the vaccine for that year. So that's why sometimes it's only, you know, 50% effective, you hear. It's still good in the sense that it still teaches your body to fight off the virus, and it still makes the symptoms lesser. So even if, you know, it doesn't completely prevent infection, you probably will have a much less severe infection if you get the flu vaccine. But the COVID vaccine is likely to be a lot more on target, partly because the virus changes more slowly, but also because now we have these mRNA vaccines. And it turns out one of the brilliant things about these vaccines is that you can tweak them pretty quickly. You can take that genetic code that I was talking about. If the virus changes that code, then you just take the new code and you make a vaccine based on that. And that whole process is a lot faster than it is with the traditional vaccine method. So the fact that these mRNA vaccines worked is really good for the coronavirus.
And yet, at the same time, parents are saying, well, this is such a new approach and such a new vaccine, I'm afraid for my child to be, quote, experimented on because we really don't know enough yet.
The mRNA vaccines are not as new as we think they are. You know, yes, we've only heard about them in the last year and a half, but these vaccines have been worked on for about 20 years. There's been so much work behind the scenes to develop them and refine them. And the technology was mature at a time when we exactly needed it. So we got very lucky. But this is something people have been working on for quite a while. And the other thing now is that think about how many hundreds of millions of people have received the mRNA vaccines worldwide. Beyond this myocarditis risk in young males of a certain age and, you know, a certain number of cases per 100,000 people vaccinated, we have not really heard of any bad side effects. And we would have by now because of the number of people who've had it. So there is really no reason to think that somehow for kids this is going to be much, much worse in some way that we don't understand. It'll probably be similar. The immune response was similar in kids. We're using a smaller dose. So when I make a decision like that as a parent, that's what I look at. Yes, I can't be 100% sure, but look at how many people have had it. Look at the fact that we, you know, have not heard about any side effects. Look at the fact that they're using a smaller dose and they're not seeing big, you know, reactions, bad reactions to it, even in the kids in the trial. So you take all of that into account, weigh them against the risk of COVID, which is really much more of a risk to any child, and then you opt for the vaccine.
What about the number of children and the age of children who receive the yearly flu vaccine? At what age is that given?
They start giving the flu vaccine, I believe, at 6 months of age. So they start pretty young. And, you know, they actually recommend the vaccine for all kids under five because those kids are the most at risk of flu. You know, the flu virus is a little bit different that way because the risk is heaviest for older people and for really young kids. Whereas for COVID, it's just a straight linear relationship. It gets worse with age. So kids have been getting flu vaccines for decades and, you know, have not had serious problems.
And most children have been getting that.
A lot of children have. I think in any given year, yeah, the uptake of the flu vaccine is not as good as we would want it to be. Sometimes it's only about 50% of the population.
Oh, I see.
But yeah, a lot of kids do end up getting it, and we have not seen any serious problems with that.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Apoorva Mandavilli. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Apoorva Mandavilli. She's a reporter for the New York Times, focusing on science and global health. So how are schools likely to deal with the issue of unvaccinated young children? California seems to be moving toward mandates for young children in schools. Certainly, the U.S. government has said adult employees have to be vaccinated or tested once a week. What's the likelihood that you could have such a small percentage of school children vaccinated that the others around them are at risk?
I think the vaccine mandate for schools is very tricky because these vaccines are not fully approved for kids. They have an emergency use authorization. And with just that, it's a little bit more challenging to say that schools should have mandates. So California has this new rule, but that's not going to kick in till next fall. And I think they're hoping that by then the vaccine will be fully approved and they can have a mandate. you know, it's going to be really dependent on how the virus behaves, I think, between now and next summer. If we continue to see cases, I think a lot more parents will come along to realizing that their kids need the vaccine. But if the virus goes away for the most part, which I don't think is going to happen, by the way, but if the virus does completely disappear from our lives, then no, you don't need the vaccine. In the conversations between all the experts who advise federal agencies, you know, the experts who advise the FDA and the CDC, there was a lot of conversation about this, about the risk benefit for kids, because it's different than for adults. And whether, you know, schools should have mandates. And of course, they don't enforce mandates. They don't even recommend mandates. But they did talk about that issue. And one of the things they ended up with is that they didn't think that mandates were the way to go, because we don't know everything about the risk-benefit ratio for kids.
If the FDA does approve, do you think that would change? Do you think a mandate would then be more realistic and would be paid attention to?
I think it would. I think once the vaccine is approved, first of all, it's going to take time. By then, many millions of kids will have been vaccinated. The parents who are hesitant will start to see that actually it is safe. Their neighbor's kid got it. Their school classmates' kids got it. You know, it's not a problem. But also, I think the schools will want to go back to normal and not have to quarantine people, not have to enforce mask use all the time, not have to have teachers get infected and have to stay home. You know, it's going to get to a point where we want our lives to be back to the convenient, easy, you know, lives that we had before. And that is not going to happen unless we have a majority of people in this country vaccinated, including kids.
You know, I'm old enough to remember taking that sugar cube for polio. And I wonder whether, should the vaccine be put into another form that would not mean an injection, do you think parents might be more likely to say, okay, I'll go with my child?
It's entirely possible. You know, if it's easier for the kids, I think that also makes it easier for parents. There are vaccines being developed that are oral vaccines, that are nasal vaccines. The nasal vaccines in particular are exciting to some scientists because that is where the virus lives when you first get infected and where you infect other people from. And so, you know, a lot of the scientists that I've spoken to say, okay, these injected vaccines are good for the first round maybe, but if what we want is to prevent the virus from infecting people over and over again, what we need is a nasal spray vaccine. And that may be an easier sell across the board. The flu vaccine, you know, they did try to develop the flu mist. It's a nasal spray. It didn't work for other reasons unrelated to the vaccine itself. But I think that, you know, there is a lot of work, there is a lot of movement toward making these other alternate means of delivery for COVID vaccines.
How do you think this resistance on the part of parents on this vaccine is going to affect their thoughts about measles or smallpox, chickenpox? I mean, vaccines that are required for young children to enter school.
It's really interesting how people have thought about this vaccine very differently from the other vaccines they're used to. You know, most parents don't really think about all the other vaccines that they have to get. Of course, there are some parents who still worry about that too. But for the most part, parents, you know, get the immunization schedule from their pediatricians. They follow them. They immunize their kids. They send them to school. This, because it's a new vaccine, I think people are a little bit more worried about. But, you know, I think so much of it is also not having been exposed to those diseases. I know I grew up in India and I really respect and trust vaccines. And I, you know, you said you remember polio. You know, that I think people who have not seen those diseases firsthand don't fully understand how much these vaccines are doing to protect us. You know, if people, anytime people have stopped taking the measles vaccine in places where the herd immunity has dipped below and we've seen cases, you know, some kids have died from measles. Kids still die from measles in other parts of the world. We have just forgotten that part because we don't see it as a big problem here. So hopefully, you know, over time, that will also be the case for COVID. COVID will also become a memory. It will become something that we can easily prevent with a vaccine, and no one will think twice about giving it to their kids.
What do we know about children's vaccinations for COVID in other parts of the world?
In Europe, they are offering the vaccine to kids. It's different in each country. Some countries are doing it only for kids 12 and up. Some are doing it for 17 and up. Some Nordic countries have decided that they're not going to offer the Moderna vaccine to any kids over, 12 to 18 or so, because they don't want to take the risk of myocarditis. So it's sort of all across the map. And then, you know, in other parts of the world, like Africa, adults don't even have vaccines really enough yet. So kids are far behind in that line.
So at this point, how important is it to vaccinate young children in order to achieve some kind of herd immunity?
We're not going to get there without kids, because if kids can get infected, they can pass it to people around them. They can pass it to their grandparents. They can pass it to their teachers. They can pass it to their caregivers. So we are not going to really see the end of this pandemic without having a majority of the population, including kids, vaccinated. So we really need a lot of these kids to get vaccinated, if not all.
And here we are on the verge of the holidays, when families, old and young, will be together. Really quite a risk for families to gather, or maybe they won't if some have not been vaccinated. I mean, what would your advice be as someone who's been following this from the beginning?
Having reported on COVID for all of this time, it's been almost traumatic just having to write about something that is killing so many people on a daily basis. I sometimes find it hard to understand why you wouldn't get the vaccine. If it is killing a couple of thousand people a day, even now, what is really stopping you from getting the vaccine? I understand the safety risks. I understand that people are worried, but ultimately we're talking about a disease here that's deadly, and I think people should opt for it, including kids. We are going into the holidays. You know, we always say we don't really know how this virus behaves, but we do know that when we start to gather indoors, it gets worse. And we really should be preparing for those holidays by protecting as many people as we can. Already we're seeing the numbers go up in some parts of the country, in the Northeast and some states, where people are starting to go indoors, and that will only get worse with the holidays and people gathering.
Well, Apoorva, we will end on that note, urging people to think very, very carefully about how they spend the holidays and how they take care of themselves and those around them. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
That was Apoorva Mandavilli, a reporter for The New York Times who focuses on science and global health. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody with help from Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.